Welcome to Modern Steel Construction's Field Notes podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Weisenberger. This month's guest is Anders Lassiter, the CEO and principal architect with Anders Lassiter Architects, located in sunny Southern California. Welcome, Anders.
Hey, thank you very much, Jeff. It's a real pleasure to be here.
I want to thank you again for being an ideas judge. We'll talk about that in a little bit. I understand your firm is in Laguna Beach. So are you a SoCal native?
I am, yeah. I guess I'm a bit of an unusual animal in that regard, since everybody here in California seems to be from somewhere else. We've got a number of folks from Chicago. I know that's where you're located. And it seems folks move out here for the weather. And I guess that's one of the reasons I never left the area, is that it's so easy to be here. It's hard for me to think of living somewhere else. I've traveled around the United States, been to almost every state, and been around the world a little bit too. And I love to travel, but there's something special about California, and it's in my blood, I guess. I'm a third generation California native, which is even more rare, I think.
When did this all start, your architecture path? When did you realize that this is what you wanted to do? Was there something specific that prompted it? Did you look at a specific building and go, oh, I want to make that?
No, you know, it's an interesting question. I think that an awareness of the built environment is something that doesn't come naturally to anyone, I don't believe. I believe it's something that's nurtured. And when you become aware of how you can look at the built environment and begin to understand your relationship to it, an entire new world of opportunity is awoken in you. And that really began for me in seventh grade woodshop class, where we were first taught how to do some basic mechanical drawing, like draw a circle with a compass. And then you could take that drawing of a circle over to the woodworking machine and you could cut out the wheel of a truck that would ultimately become a little wood truck planter that you can give to your mother for Mother's Day. And so that kind of relationship between the act of drawing something and then being able to create something from the drawing and then being able to see the reaction that you elicit from someone you gave that thing you made to, that was so powerful, and it left in me this really strong desire to be a creator. And so as I grew up from there, I realized I had an ability to draw, and drawing architectural drawings was fascinating to me. And then as I learned how to relate to the built environment and how to see buildings in a more specific, more intentional way, I realized that's really what I wanted to be. It was either be an architect or be a rock and roll drummer, which I was pretty serious about. But I decided architecture was probably the better way to have a more regular paycheck anyway.
Sure. And I definitely want to get back to the drumming in a bit. So can you tell me, where did you study architecture?
Sure. I studied locally here, first at Orange Coast College, which is one of the local community colleges in Orange County here, and did 2 years there and realized I really love this and I wanted to go to university. So from there, I went to Cal Poly Pomona, which is one of our local schools here, really great school for architecture. And there at the 5-year university for undergrad in architecture, fell in love with what it meant to think about making and how we can develop processes for creating architectural form that involve abstract ideas, and that we don't just make decisions about what a building should look like on whim. We don't use our whimsy. We don't just wake up one day and say, ooh, I want to make a curvy building or a pointy building. But rather, meaningful buildings are made through a series of thoughts and abstract ideas that lead you to make certain decisions. And that became such a powerful idea to me, I decided that I wanted to go further. So I went to grad school at UCLA and did my graduate degree in architectural theory. And I did a minor in music theory, which was a really interesting combination because I was convinced that there would be a way to bring music and architecture together, and that I could bring my two loves, my two passions, into confluence and allow one to influence the other and vice versa. So it was a really great time for experimentation and trying out new ideas. And it led to some great failures as well as some good successes. But I think that's what school is meant to be. It's a place where you can, you know, be adventurous and try different things. And that really helped set my path forward for how I would create buildings in the future.
Okay, absolutely. No, I see what you're saying. I started college as a music major myself. I quickly determined that I didn't want to be a performer, and I wasn't meant to be a teacher. So I kept playing, but I didn't make that my career path.
Yeah, music is a funny thing. You know, it's a lifelong joy. And if you play any instrument, I don't care if it's the kazoo or, you know, banjo or whatever, you can have with you for the rest of your life the great satisfaction of making music, if for no one else but yourself. Sure. And I've always enjoyed that to a great degree, and really cherished that. The level of understanding and technical ability you need to have to study music and to be a professional in the music business, whether it's teaching, as you mentioned, or even performing, that was another level of existence that I realized I probably couldn't attain. It wasn't really within my grasp, whereas architecture felt like it was a natural extension of me. I could think and be and act like an architect fairly naturally. So that was where I made that decision, where in my life I would pursue it as my primary career and let music be that thing that I could always fall back to and get instant gratification from. Because you can imagine, being an architect, it takes years sometimes to develop buildings and to see the fruit of your labor, but it takes mere minutes to turn around and pick up a guitar or sit down at the piano or the drums and you know, whip out something just for your own personal instant gratification. So music is a great counterbalance to my architecture.
Sure. No, I like that. The idea of a counterbalance. I almost was going to say compromise, but compromise isn't really a worthy word. It's that makes it sound like you're compromising, so to speak. But no, I think it balance is the better word for it.
And they do really inform one another to a great degree. You know, what I think about in music that makes great music great is that there's internal structure, there's dynamic, there's deviation from the norm, from a datum point, and great architecture is similarly based on order and rigor and dynamic and all of the things we find in a great piece of music, you can see in great pieces of architecture. So the two are so closely related, and yet they're also so very far apart, right? Architecture exists in three dimensions all at once, where music is temporal, right? It starts and it has a finish. It's in time. So they don't exist in the same kind of dimensional plane, but they have very similar qualities.
Well, so speaking of buildings, you know, once you kind of became aware of buildings, or, you know, like you said, it doesn't come naturally to a lot of people. Were there certain buildings early on that you found particularly inspiring or that maybe influenced your work?
The guy that I really do love the most, I think, is Louis Kahn. It's because he, more than any other architect that I know of, designed the building for the occupant, for the person to be in it. He understood that there was a very sensual relationship between the human body and the building that it occupies. And he always had that, it seems, in the front of his mind as he would make design decisions. And some of his buildings are very monumental and they're very, you know, large. And you think to yourself, my God, the scale of this, how could you relate it to the human body? But he would play against that scale and create very small spaces within the building that you could almost crawl into. So the human body was always in this duality between the grandness of his large scale and then the more human-sized, small scale parts of the building. And that dynamic, that ability for the body to feel in two places at once, is an incredible subconscious feeling that makes for an outstanding architecture.
I think it is interesting, especially when you have like a family who can, you know, frankly, a family that can afford to say, make me the building, the house that I want it to be. I always wondered. So like you have people who have like, they'll trust you as an architect, but they'll say, I have these specific desires. And then so the architect, you know, a good architect will say, okay, sure, I can make that happen, knowing that somebody's not going to live there for, you know, they might even be there for the rest of their lives. But Is there ever any sort of, you know, if you ever have any special requests like that, is there any sort of like also thinking ahead to what the next person might think of the house? Or is that not really a concern? Because, you know, obviously, if you build a building for, you know, to last forever, it's going to be, you know, multiple people living in and over the life of the building.
For sure. And I get really excited at the idea that the things we do today might actually far outlive me, and that in, God forbid, you know, 100 years from now, what a blessing it would be to know that somebody was still occupying a home that I very carefully and thoughtfully designed and very intentionally brought into being. That to me is one of the most satisfying things about the work that I do, is knowing that it's going to live beyond my own existence. But with that in mind, we do try to think about universal, timeless responses, so that whether it's the client I'm designing for today or that person's grandchildren who might inherit the house, or any number of people who might come to that home or that building later in time, that the universal good quality of what makes an architecture timeless is at the forefront of our thinking, and that we don't rely on trend. We try to stay away from fancy. We try to stay away from what's, you know, current. And we always look for what's universal. There are some fundamental things that make good architecture for a human being. Ideas about good quality of space and proportion of that space, good quality of light in that space, and then what is the space made out of? What is its material? And I found that if we follow that recipe, space, proportion, light, and material, in that order, we will always end up with a great piece of architecture that will live far beyond today's fashion. So I really do try to avoid trend. I found that if my client is looking at a trend they really like and they really want that trend, it usually means we're going to be well behind that trend by the time the house is done. So, you know, being on trend means you're already behind. I try to convince them to trust in me that I can give them a more suitable, timeless response.
I live in a 100-year-old house, for example, and my 100-year-old house in a lot of ways resembles the 100-year house next door. And in other ways, it is completely different.
Well, it's an interesting question that you bring up, which is to say, given a set of limitations that you have to begin with, can you be creative within those limitations? And when I'm thinking about that, I always fall back to one of my favorite people, although he's a musician, I consider him a great designer as well. And that was Igor Stravinsky, who would design the most avant-garde music of his time. And Igor Stravinsky used to say that the greater the restrictions I placed upon myself, the more creative I found my response. And I think that message resonates true with architecture as well. I often find that the projects that are harder for me are the ones where I have less limitations.
Can we talk a little bit about your firm itself? You know, so Your name is on the firm. When did you start it, and what made you decide to strike out on your own?
Sure, that's a good question. I think I must have known always that I would like to have my own firm. I tend to like things my way. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Capricorn, you know. My way or the highway has always been my way of thinking. And I'm not always right, and I'll be the first to admit that I'm not always right, although as a Capricorn, I find it hard to admit that I'm wrong, but I will from time to time. But I had the great fortune of, during my schooling for architecture, I worked for some of the best firms here in the Orange County area. And as I was finishing graduate school at UCLA, I was working for an architect in Orange County named Mark Singer. And Mark was doing some really wonderful modern homes here in the Laguna Beach area that was really pushing the boundaries of what houses were, especially here in Orange County. And so I learned how to be an architect working under his tutelage. I learned how to create buildings, to make buildings, to have them built, how to interact with clients, you know, how to create contracts, and the kinds of things that an architect needs to know, not only to be a good maker of buildings, but also a good business person. And it came to a point where Mark and I were kind of looking at each other, and I think we both realized he didn't really want to give me anything in the way of his firm, and I didn't really want to stay and kind of play second fiddle. So we came to an agreement that it was probably time for me to step out on my own. And I remember the day it happened. It was the end of March in 2006. I take it back. And so I woke up on a Saturday the next day. It was April Fool's Day. And I woke up realizing that I'd quit my job. It was a well-paying job, and I had great clients doing awesome projects, but that I had to figure out what to do next. And I had two kids and a wife at home staring at me going, okay, smart guy, you wanted it your way or the highway. Now you got it. What are you going to do about it? I don't think there's a more motivating thing than waking up in the morning, realizing you don't have a job and you've got three hungry mouths to feed and you've got talent and ability, so you need to go put it to work. And I remember getting out of bed, kind of sobbing, you know, in my milk and coffee that morning. And then by noon that day, I had already reached out to a dozen different contacts that I had. And the universal question was, what took you so long? We've been waiting, you know, that kind of thing. So I had the good fortune of having a great network of people that I was connected to. And those people did an exceptional job of helping me accelerate my firm, and pretty quickly we were off and running.
You said you wanted, you know, one thought was to become a rock and roll drummer. I think I'd even heard before a heavy metal drummer. So when did this all begin?
Yeah. If you could ask my mother, she'd tell you I was born to play the drums because some of my earliest memories were sitting on the kitchen floor in front of the cabinets, having pulled out all of the pots and pans and just sitting there banging away with wooden spoons and the like. And I remember even hanging the metal lids for the pans, hanging them with string off the handles of the cabinets to create my cymbals. And so I don't know where it came from originally, but somewhere along the line, I became infatuated with what the drums looked like, how they sounded, the idea of sitting behind them and commanding them and creating this you know, rhythm and the driving force behind music was really exciting for me. And to my mother's credit, she herself was a musician. She played the piano beautifully and her family was very musical. She encouraged it and put me into a marching band early when I was in third grade. I remember we had a little snare drum marching group in our school and then went on to drum lessons. And she thankfully forced me to take piano lessons as well. And so growing up, I was playing the piano, playing the drums. I taught myself guitar and now I play the bass guitar as well. So I'm not specifically or terrifically good on any of them, but I do pretty darn well and I can keep myself entertained. And my bandmates are equally tolerable of my limited skills. In the 80s, when I was in high school, the things that I remember the most, the bands that stand out, of course, would be like Judas Priest and Iron Maiden and AC/DC and Motley Crue. All of that kind of genre created this great soup, this incredible cacophony of, you know, power-driven music, guitar-heavy music, where the drummer and the guitar players are, you know, everybody's just equally a part of this band and there isn't anyone that stands out. It's all working together. And I found that kind of idea of collaboration within that music so powerful. I had the good fortune of studying part of my drum lesson time with a gentleman who had taught Lars Ulrich his double bass technique.
Oh, wow.
And he would always tell me, well, when I was teaching Lars, you know, this or that. And I was like, man, if I could ever be anything like Lars with that double bass drum technique, that would be amazing. So, you know, but to go back to an earlier thought I'd said, that was one of the things that was really clear to me is that while I loved music and I was good at my music, I realized I also had a set of limitations that was going to probably keep me from being somebody like a Lars Ulrich that is so good at that craft and so dedicated to what you need to do to keep yourself maintained at that level that I stepped away from the music to embrace the architecture. So I don't know, in some ways I feel like I found the complementary thing that I could be that passionate about. And I love dedicating my life to making buildings and don't really have any question or qualm about it. But the music thing was a little harder for me to dedicate to. So it was kind of, the world sort of made that decision for me, or the universe sort of made that decision for me.
Sure, sure. Well, so speaking of Lars Ulrich, just one more question about the drumming. Did you have other specific inspirations? Like there are people you can point to?
Yeah, well, you might think it's funny and people give him a lot of grief and don't really give him the rights that he's due in terms
of...
Are
you going to say Ringo Starr?
Yeah, absolutely. The first song I learned to play on the drums was it was a Beatles song. And it was so powerful to me the way Ringo, he has an incredible feel to his drumming. And what I really like is the notes that Ringo chooses not to play are so strategic and so well thought out that his ability to lay down the drums and complement the work of the rest of that group, it's truly sublime. If you listen to his drumming and if you've ever tried to duplicate what he does, you understand that it's not easy. The man was really quite skilled.
Sure. No, it's funny. I just kind of guess Ringo Starr because he is one of those people who I feel like tends to be underappreciated. And a lot of people say Ringo Starr, luckiest guy in the world, but
not a chance.
No, I agree with you 100%. They also said he was a human metronome. He could keep a steady beat better than any other drummer. And he was also one of the first people, I think, instead of just having the drums kind of be down behind everybody, he raised them, put them on a platform.
That what Ringo did is he brought the drums up so that his head was at the same elevation as everyone else's head. And it created a unified feeling. And isn't that really what the Beatles really created, was this sense of complete and total harmony between the four of them? And there really didn't ever feel like there was a standout, right? It was always a band and they were always working together to create this other thing, which was their music. I believe that's really what elevated everything that they did. And Ringo had a huge role in that. My God. You know, another interesting tidbit, he was a left-handed guy, but he played a right-handed drum kit. So what that meant was a lot of his drum fills, as he moves around the drum set, he's leading with his left hand, which is awkward, but that's why some of his drum fills are actually off by a beat or a half a beat, because he's moving around the kit in a different way than a regular right-handed drummer might. And that's actually part of what makes his sound so unique.
Let's talk a little bit about the Ideas Awards. The Ideas 2 Awards, for which you were a judge.
Every one of the winners this year exhibits is that there is an innovative way that steel is used in these projects. It's used in a way that is clearly structural, which I think is part of the reason we use steel, is that it has great structural capacity. But the structure itself isn't just there as what's needed, and it's not just there to support something else. But the winners in this year's awards were really the ones that used steel in a way where the role of steel is celebrated and allowed to become greater than just a support role. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I say all the time is that a great building is going to look as good finished as it does when it's under construction. And by that, I mean, I often find that buildings in their construction stage exhibit a real great inherent beauty. They have rhythm and order, they have rigor, and they have a logic to them that oftentimes gets covered up with the finished materials. Mm-hmm. And you may end up going, gosh, that finished product doesn't look as good as it did when it was in construction. But invariably, all of the projects that won, you could see that in the construction of the object, the logic of how steel was being used not only was really elegant in the construction of the project, but it was also very elegantly exhibited in the finished project.
You have a goal, I understand, of visiting all 50 states. I'm just curious, how close are you to that goal of 50 states?
That's an interesting question. My wife decided that this was something she wanted to do, and we've made a very distinct effort to try and hit all 50. She's a little bit ahead of me because sometimes during the summer, she'll just head off and go visit one or two on her own, which I think is a really wonderful thing for her to do. We were just planning our trip to Tennessee and West Virginia, which will take us, I think, down to 4 states remaining. So she's got 4 left on her list. I think I've got 6 left on the list. And we're saving Alaska for the end. I'm not sure why, other than it just seems like a good way to round out the list. So the fun part of this, though, has been bringing our children along. And we will vacation, you know, sometimes in strange places. People say, oh, where are you going on vacation this year? I said, oh, we're going to head over to Wisconsin and maybe, you know, Ohio. And they're like, oh, you must have family out there. I said, no, we just want to see what's up in Wisconsin and Ohio. And you know what? There's really cool stuff in every one of the states. Every area has so many unique and remarkable qualities, beautiful things to see, amazing people to meet. We've really enjoyed this kind of travel because it gives you the opportunity to connect with folks at a really meaningful level. You're becoming part of their community if for just a brief time. And they're very pleased when you tell them, where are you from? Southern California. They're like, what? That's where we go to vacation. Why would you come here? I said, because I want to see this. You know, this is America. And it truly is an amazing place with such diversity of landscape, diversity of people, diversity of culture, diversity of food, diversity of music and history, that it's become just an amazing tour of really the world when you think about it, because of the people who live here. The world lives here,